Across the desk, Avrakatos was anything but disapproving of Wilson. He was delighted by the way the Texan was sticking it to Kogan with a shower of references to his intimate friendships with Zia and Akhtar. His Texas benefactress, who had Zia's ear, his high-level Pentagon contacts who were advising him about how the CIA should be running the war, even informing Kogan that he had convinced his great friend the Egyptian defense minister to sell 894 SA-7 anti-aircraft missiles for use in the war. Reading between the lines, Wilson was saying that since the agency wasn't doing anything to counter the Hind, he damn well would. And what was Chuck Kogan going to do about that? Kogan managed to push Wilson to the breaking point when he offered a long-winded explanation about why the agency could not possibly introduce the Erlikon into Afghanistan. It had to do with concealing the American hand, plausible deniability, the CIA's time-honored rule permitting only weapons of Russian origin in a secret war with the Soviets. Why? Wilson asked defiantly, pointing out that President Reagan was publicly acknowledging U.S. assistance to the Afghans. As the exchange started to break down, Avrakatos felt a certain institutional loyalty and jumped in to save the day. "We'll be happy to look into your suggestion," he said with uncharacteristic diplomacy. "Mr. Kogan is absolutely correct that it is not what we have been doing, but I'll have my experts look into it." The ride back to Langley was exquisite for Avrakatos. As he says, "I mean, what boss wants to get reamed in front of his subordinates?" Kogan didn't talk much, except to say he really didn't want to see that man again. Avrakatos, on the other hand, figured he had spotted a kindred spirit, a congressman with power who talked dirty and who wasn't afraid to say he wanted to kill Russians and get even for Vietnam. On the Hill, Wilson was now in the middle of the annual appropriations feeding frenzy. Secretaries and undersecretaries of the Navy, Army, and Air Force, and the long chain of defense contractors from General Dynamics, McDonnell Douglas, GE, Lockheed, and LTV all lined up, waiting their turn to plead their cases with the always receptive big spender on defense. Dennis Neal and the main foreign aid recipients were also putting in appearances, Tzvi Rafia from Israel and Mohammed Abu Razala from Egypt. Wilson would take care of them all, but his mind and energies were now focused on getting more help for Pakistan and the Mujahideen. By his side was Joanne Herring, a full-fledged conspirator in their secret campaign. They began using code language on the phone, talking about eagles and how many hawks had landed that week. Wilson also had her sit in on one of his CIA briefings and encouraged her to explain why they needed to do more. One can only imagine what the officials reported back to their bosses at Langley. The two Texans went to visit Wilson's old advisor on Israeli strategic concerns, Edward Lutwak, described on the dust jackets of his many books as the most brilliant and controversial defense analyst and military historian writing today. Lutwak would later burst into the national consciousness during the Gulf War, with his numerous network appearances warning that the U.S. Army would take horrendous casualties if General Norman Schwarzkopf launched a ground war against Saddam Hussein. He was dramatically wrong, but as always, impressive and full of authority. When Joanne and Charlie descended on him in 1983, he had just completed an assignment for the Pentagon to design the mix of weapons that a light infantry division could use to battle the Soviets in mountainous terrain. Because of this, he had become unquestionably the most knowledgeable figure in Washington about light, portable anti-aircraft weapons. Lutwak had some bad news. The Afghan War could never become Russia's Vietnam, he said. It was a lost cause. The best Mujahideen fighters were being wiped out, and the CIA was right not to provide American weapons to the tribesmen. It would be foolish to provoke the Russians into an attack on Pakistan. But Charlie and Joanne were not there to be told they were chasing a lost cause. They wanted to find out which gun to buy. Lutwak said there were only three non-American versions available on the world market. He was partial to the Swiss Erlikon. He had actually visited the Swiss mountain forces and was confident that, although the primitive Afghans were not up to using most sophisticated weapons, the Erlikon could work for them. It wasn't complicated, and it was light enough that the barrel could be carried on a line of mules. Now, the amorphous drive to help the Mujahideen had a specific focus. Wilson was envisioning Erlikons on every mountaintop in Afghanistan. He told Joanne that his first challenge was not likely to take place in the House. He owned the Appropriations Subcommittee, but the Senate would have to sign off on it, and there the most important man would be the Alaska Republican Ted Stevens, chairman of the Senate Defense Appropriations Subcommittee. This was Joanne's territory, the Republican establishment, and she quickly applied her formula for making things happen by organizing a dinner for the senator with Lord Robert Cranborne as the guest of honor. This was vintage Joanne. Cranborne had one of those titles that inevitably impress Americans. A friend of Charlie Fawcett's, Cranborne had been actively involved in the Afghan War from the beginning. He flew over on the Concorde for the dinner with the specific mission of lobbying the senator. That night the English lord talked eloquently about how the U.S. media had no compunction about reporting every negative thing it could find about Vietnam, but in Afghanistan, the press seemed willing to give the Red Army a free ride as it pursued a policy of near genocide. It was hard not to be impressed with Cranborne, who was then running Afghan Aid, a foundation that provided assistance to Ahmad Shah Massoud in the Panjshir, helping Massoud keep his men in the field. It was an effective evening, a creative exercise on Joanne's part, carefully designed to cast Charlie in a new light with the powerful senator who chaired the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee. For the Erlikon bill to sneak through, Wilson was going to need Stevens's support. Joanne was systematically putting Charlie together with other powerful Republican friends as well. Wilson had met Caspar Weinberger, the Secretary of Defense, and CIA Director Bill Casey when they'd testified before his committees, but that had been bloodless and very different from being known as the honored friend of the fascinating, well-connected, arch-conservative Joanne Herring. "I'd give them all the pitch about Charlie," remembers Joanne. "I'd say he isn't just a boll weevil, he's better. He's your most significant instrument because he's a real Democrat, but he believes what you believe." All of this was done, Joanne acknowledged years later, so that when D'Artagnan came charging with his light brigade, he wouldn't meet an irresistible force. One of the peculiarities of the CIA's Afghan campaign was that none of the agency officers knew or dealt with the Afghans they were supporting. This was one of Zia's conditions that the CIA had agreed to in order to win the right to operate out of Pakistan. But Charlie Wilson was not bound by any such restrictions. And so in the fall of 1983, when an Afghan doctor who lived in Orlando, Florida, called to say that his brother, the interim chief of the CIA's Mujahideen Alliance, was in town, Wilson quickly agreed to a meeting. "Professor Sigbatullah Mojadedi is a small man with glasses and a gray beard, and the story he told that day moved and enraged Wilson. Mojadedi, a Muslim intellectual who speaks six languages, comes from a family said to be descended from the third caliph. By the time he shook hands with Wilson, more than 100 members of his immediate family had been assassinated, killed, or simply lost somewhere in the mountains of Afghanistan. He himself had been jailed and tortured in 1978 after protesting in Kabul. What caught Wilson's imagination as he listened to the Afghan leader was his insistence that the Soviets could not win. They are not a superpower. There is only one superpower, Allah.